evening. You know, the last time that people sat like this at an event that we planned, I came and took out the first two rows so that people were sitting in the front. I'm just kidding. You've all behaved like good Lutherans, whether you're Lutheran or not. You're welcome to come and sit closer if you like. You don't have to sit all organized. You can spread out in the space. I'd like to welcome you to Lutheran Church of the Cross. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Laura Holk, and I co-pastor here with my husband, Phil, who's over there in the sound booth. He'll wave to you. Yeah, it's our honor and privilege to keep inviting people and welcoming people into this space, and I'd like to remind us all that we're gathered on Treaty 7 territory, the traditional land of the Treaty 7 peoples. The indigenous peoples, their ways of being are ways of hospitality and respect and dignity. And so we always say that we're gathered on Treaty 7 territory as a reminder that from their hospitality comes our hospitality. So we're all called together to build a place of dignity and respect and inclusion. So welcome. I'd like to introduce Jacqueline Liefling. She is an engineer. She has actually spent her master's studies on solar energy, and as part of her project, installed solar panels on her mother's house, so is well-versed in not only industrial uses for solar energy, but also residential uses. And so it's my pleasure to turn the helm over to her as she makes us all experts in the 30 minutes or 45 minutes that she has, or however long she's going to take. Welcome. Thanks, Jacqueline.
Recording this, so excuse the formality. As Laura said, I'm Jacqueline. I go to this church, and I'm happy to just share some of my knowledge of how I acquired this expertise in solar. So my background is I'm a chemical engineer. I went to UBC, but I'm from Calgary. And then I decided that clean energy was kind of tugging at my heartstrings, so I got a support from the bank, and I shipped off to England, and I studied out there. So this is direct from another island where they kind of know what they're doing, and I brought it back here. And lo and behold, we are slowly but surely turning in that direction. So I've now acquired the skill set that's a little bit on the front of the wave, which was my goal. And my goal here today, and kind of in general, is just to share this knowledge with people so that we all know what the ins and outs are of solar. We're very well versed, we're very smart people in terms of everything in our daily lives, but this is kind of something new that's just coming into practice and in mainstream. So by me sharing this with you, the education can spread, and then when those people come to install in your house or to suggest it, or that your company starts buzzing about it, you kind of have those basic knowledges to take that forward to kind of dispel some of those myths and misconceptions that people do think about solar. So, this is a workshop I put on a year ago, actually, April 9th. So, we did this in Cochrane for a public scenario just like this, and it's had a few tweaks along the way, and it's an ever-evolving process, solar in Canada especially. So, this is the basic outline. I don't really need to go through it because we'll hit everything. I'm going to gloss through some steps because this was made for originally like a full 2.5-hour morning. Some of it's been cut out and re-added, like I said, so there's going to be a couple beefy slides we'll skim over because they're boring. So, what is solar power? Solar power, the definition of solar is something derived from the sun. So it comes from the sun's rays. And what happens in the sun is that it's at an extremely high temperature and an even higher pressure. So that creates nuclear fusion. And those atoms dispel a ton of energy. So they dispel from the sun to the earth what is known as a photon. So the photon is essentially a particle with no mass, but that is what holds the energy. And those shoot across the galaxy and they come to earth in an amount of energy for us to use that we call solar energy. So the amount of energy on earth is substantial but manageable. And so I wrote that in because if we were too hot, we wouldn't be here. And if we were too cold, we wouldn't be here. So we're in this very fine niche, and I think some of us have probably heard the NASA announcements about those habitable zones and new planets they're finding. We are a very unique case of being able to sustain life and have water, and that is from the very finite and very small range of solar energy that we get here. The amount of solar energy that we have also enables photosynthesis. It allows our plants to grow. It allows our beings to have life. The term that we use for solar power as it enters the Earth's atmosphere is called solar irradiance. So irradiance is the power per unit area that's produced by the sun. So it's measured in a watt per meter squared. It is dependent on the time, the location, your surface orientation, a lot of different variables. What I want to distinguish between right now is power versus energy. A lot of people use those two terms interchangeably, but power, in fact, is like a light bulb. You have a light bulb that's unplugged that has a power rating of 100 watts. The second you plug that into the outlet, it starts drawing energy, and you turn it on. So the energy is the power times the amount of time that you use it for. So they're really two different things, although we do use them interchangeably. We do distinguish between them, especially in terms of solar power, because there's a capacity and a potential for energy, but you don't always necessarily make 100% of that. So we'll come back to that again. This is what's known as the solar constant. So solar comes from the sun, as I mentioned, through the vacuum of space, and it hits the edge of the atmosphere. That edge of the atmosphere is what's known as the solar constant. So that value is constant. But what happens is when it enters the atmosphere, it is subject to a ton of scattering and atmospheric effects. So only 70% of what is in the solar constant at the edge of the atmosphere is actually available to us on the surface. And so that is because some of it's scattered in the water molecules, some is the dust and particulates, some actually bounces off things, bounces back from the clouds out back to the atmosphere. And so we don't get all of it here. So this is Alberta's solar resource. Here's a map. This is called the Global Solar Atlas, I believe. So they kind of map the potential. So this is what the sun has transmitted to the Earth and where it's highest in North America. So I've only included North America, but you can see the high purple spots. That's really, really high. That's really hot desert temperatures. Then there's the dark, dark red. Is there a pointer on this, Phil? Is it the green one? Thank you. Okay, great. So this is obviously great desert sunshine, and the closer you get to the equator, the better the sunshine is. But you can see in Canada, we actually here, this is Alberta right here, we have a really, really good hot spot relative to how north we are. So this is what makes Alberta really unique in terms of our solar resource. We have very good sun here, and I'm going to touch on why Alberta is actually better for solar production than this high irradiance area as we go through the slides, because this is a big misconception. People think the hot, higher, better sun, there is a lot more potential. However, there is a downside. So we'll come back to that. Just as a relative comparison, this is the exact same scale in Europe. So it's no surprise that Germany has a ton of solar installed, and England has a ton of solar installed. But if you look at the actual comparative value and potential, that's like astronomically different. So if they can make it work, we sure as heck can make it work. And that's what we're working towards, is kind of coming up to speed, because the amount that they have there and here and are running 90%, sometimes 100% of their generation for the day on all solar, it makes you go, hmm. So we're still catching up with our hmm. Solar collection. So this is in the solar world how we define those pieces of the full collection. So we have three general types of irradiance that we capture with solar energy. We have direct, diffuse, and albedo. The direct beam irradiation is what we call it, and it is on a big blue sky sunny day where you can feel that hot sun burning you in that one part of your body. If you're turned to the left and the sun is there, it is hot and beaming right at you. Diffuse is a day like today, so we had lots of cloud cover, and it spreads itself over the whole sky, and it actually doesn't even seem like it's sunny, but there's a lot of still irradiance coming through, just more uniform across the sky. Albedo is essentially reflection. So albedo comes into play when you have lots of water surrounding or snow. It can actually reflect the irradiance and kind of increase that value for your solar collectors. As I mentioned, the collection is affected by the absorption, scattering, time of year, weather, location, angle. There's a lot of variables, and we're going to walk through a few of them, but this is the big component of the education that I want to kind of close the gap on, is that there's a ton of variables. So when people say, oh, how much am I going to make, and is it viable, and can I just put it on my house? The answer is, well, yeah, but. And we'll kind of come through that. This is the key One of my key messages is that angles make a difference. And we're going to show you why, and I think this one next is okay. So this is a slide I've referenced correctly, so we're good. I ripped it off from my master's program, though. this is how one of the ways that we measure the angles for the collection of solar power. So this is what's known as the horizontal system observer. If you're a person standing in the center of this half sphere, the sun rises in the east, which is over there in this case, and sets in the west. And if you're in the northern hemisphere, it does that on the south side of the sky, and if you're in the south hemisphere, it does it in the north side of the sky. So inherently, in Calgary, in Alberta, in the northern hemisphere, fairly northern hemisphere, we're not close to the equator by any means, the sun is predominantly in the south side of the sky, and it rises significantly from west to east, east to west. So that's one angle that we talk about. I think I skipped past that quickly. As the sun rises in the east and goes to the west, the angle relative to the horizontal changes. This is what's called the elevation angle. So as it gets higher in the sky, it gets to its noon point, which is the highest elevation angle of the day, and then it starts to descend again. Elevation angle is one of the important angles in the calculations for solar. The azimuth is also a very important angle. The sign convention can change for this, but essentially in North America, when we are facing south to see the sun, if you're facing due south, that's a 0 or a 180, depending on what you're talking to. But essentially, it's where you are relative to due south. So that changes and that affects the amount of solar that you're able to capture. So the azimuth is a term that you'll hear often in solar. Azimuth, tilt angle, elevation angle, or those are the key ones. So this is, those of you that know me, this my nerd level's just about to like zoom up. This is a really cool slide that I love, and I'll get there in a sec. But essentially, when you're setting up a solar panel, as I mentioned, the sun changes throughout the day. It also changes throughout the year. So in the winter, we know it's a super low sun, and then in the summer, it's higher. So this is an always dynamic system. Nothing's fixed. So when you set up your tilted solar panel towards the south, there's an optimal angle that's going to capture the most amount of sun throughout the year. There's also being able to adjust that angle for whether it's summer or winter. What we do if you want a fixed angle, which is the easiest, simple, no moving parts system, you use kind of this rule of thumb in solar, which is the angle of the latitude that you're at. There's a kind of a caveat to that where we're at 51 degrees, and because we're in the more northerly part of the northern hemisphere, we use the latitude angle usually minus 15 degrees, just as a rule of thumb. If you get close to the equator's at 0, your angle's 0. You want your panels as flat as can be so they can get the whole day sun, because that angle doesn't change very much. So in Calgary, let's say we were at Montana, the border of Montana and Wyoming, so their angle's 45 degrees. The ideal angle for them would be a 45 degree tilt to capture the best amount of sun throughout the whole year without changing. Here's the nerdy part. So this was a demonstration site that they set up in Switzerland back in 2008, I believe. It's since been decommissioned, but they essentially gathered all this data and said, if you're at 45 degrees and you're capturing 100% of your available capture at 45 degrees, what happens if you turn it southwest? And what happens if you turn it southeast? And what happens if you turn it so it's at a 0 degree tilt? And the significant differences for the capture, the one that I think is most commonly probably misinterpreted, is if you put it on a flat wall, you're actually losing 30% of what you're able to capture just by putting it on a flat wall instead of the 45 degree capture. The second you turn that another just 45 degrees to the southeast or southwest, you've lost a significant amount. So while this is not to deter you if you don't have that perfect south-facing 45-degree angle roof. This is kind of to give you a perspective so that when it does come time to do your own economics and understand your own generation, you know what your perfect scenario is, and you can aim to your optimization scenario as opposed to kind of stacking those losses so that it doesn't become anywhere near what it could be for your site. So here's a little bit of how we convert this sunshine into electricity. I was not an electrical engineer before this. There's a few electrical engineers in here, so they know a lot about semiconductors, but this was very new for me. Semiconductor is a substance that, just like it sounds, it sometimes conducts. It's a semiconductor, not all the time conducting. So a semiconductor usually performs better in hot temperatures, so, or not better, it is temperature dependent. So some key principles. This is back to like high school atoms. So if you think about the atom, it has the nucleus and all the electrons and various energy levels. Those exterior electrons sit in what's called a valence band. And what happens is when the photons shine on the solar panel of made up of the semiconductor material, those valence electrons are shot with enough energy that they actually shoot out to what's known as a conduction band. And I like to use the analogy of if you're standing beside Fish Creek and you throw a stick in it, it's going to go with the creek. So the conduction band's kind of like a flowing, without anything flowing in it. It enables the electron to move. So this electron gets shot into the conduction band, and by us attaching a conductor material in that semiconductor, it actually enables the flow of electrons. So the key thing for photons is to have enough energy to kick that electron into the conduction band from the valence band. That is the principles of how semiconductors and solar power works in general. We accomplish this by several different mechanisms and several different materials, and I'll go through those coming up. So some basic vocabulary that I distinguish between in my presentations at least, solar cell. So the cell is actually a little tiny square. It's very fine material. It's made up of silicon usually, silicon semiconductor. And it looks like that. So that's what I call the solar cell. Solar module is a whole bunch of little cells put together to make the squares that you see on people's roofs. So we call that a module. Or a panel, solar panel. Once the cells all come together, they get used in a panel. If you put a whole bunch of modules or panels together, that's what we call a solar array or a solar system. So those are kind of the three terms that we go between, but I do try to keep distinguishing between them because they are very different and they are all small pieces of the whole, but you need them all. So here's some types of solar technology. So monocrystalline silicon. As I mentioned, silicon is one of the most popular materials that we accomplish the semiconductor transfer with. That's how this all started. So we use monocrystalline silicon. So what happens is they start with a single crystal of silicon. They actually grow it in these circular forms. They grow them in cylinders, and this method is called, my like Russian accent's bad, but it's like the Cholkowski method or something like that. They grow it in this special method. It takes a long time, it's really arduous, and then they shave them into tiny little wafers, they call them. But this is not exactly space friendly to have these circular wafers, so then they chop off the corners. The benefits, and so that's, sorry, I'm skipping ahead a bit. The benefits are of chopping off the corners, and it's for space saving. So now you can fit more of those cells into the square. Any of those panels that you see with that diamond shape, those are monocrystalline because they've been chopped from circles. And so there's little gaps that they can't quite fill in. So if you see a panel with those little characteristic diamond patterns, that's a monocrystalline silicon made of one crystal. The benefit to the monocrystalline is, as the name suggests, I think it's in here. It's made up of one crystal, so it becomes a very orderly structure. So if we think back to how semiconductors function, the photons shoot out the valence electrons into the conduction band, but they can do that in a really clean pathway because the monocrystalline is very orderly. It's very clean, it's very structured. So monocrystalline are the highest efficiency of the silicon cells. Next, we have polycrystalline. Polycrystalline means many crystals. So if you think about smashing up all those little wafers and mushing them together, that's what polycrystalline is. They're slightly less effective than monocrystalline. As you can imagine, all those boundaries are kind of jagged now, so those pathways for the valence electrons aren't as clean, but it's still very high efficient. And the benefit you get from polycrystalline is you don't have any more diamonds. So you can actually fill up a lot more on the module with the actual semiconductor material, which kind of counteracts the negatives of having a little bit less efficient material. So actually, value for money, it's pretty common industry practice that polycrystalline is the best value for dollar because you get more material for a bit of a cheaper cost. And the efficiencies are still relatively high. So alloy materials, there's lots of alloys that they're mushing together in the labs and trying to figure out how to make really high efficiency solar cells. So this is what's known as gallium arsenide, indium phosphide, aluminum gallium arsenide, and there's lots of variations of this. These are really, really high efficiency solar cells. But the materials that they're made with are also much more rare, harder to extract, and really hard to work with. So this solar technology is really, really only used in specialized circumstances where the cost is justified. And those special circumstances are on the Mars rover. This is where we use this kind of material in space because you can justify that high cost for really high efficiency. There's also less losses when you get that direct solar radiance without the effects of the atmosphere. So that's all I have on solar in space. I'm sorry if that's super intriguing. Thin film. Thin film's a really, really unique one that's kind of coming into its own these days only. Amorphous silicon is another version of silicon that we use, but what they do is they take a substrate, and you can literally use anything. You can use plastics or metals or alloys or really any material, and they shoot single atoms of that silicon onto it. So it's a very, very thin film of silicon, and that enables the thin film to be able to be malleable, so you can make the rolling solar cells and you can make the flexible panels, but you can also produce them for extremely cheap in a module form. So there are solar modules made out of thin film and they're just a straight black and they're really, really cheap, which is the benefit. They're also less efficient because there's less material. There's less jumping ability for those electrons. Cadmium telluride. This is one of the most popular thin film materials. Again, a little bit more rare, but because they use way less material, they can produce them for really, really cheap. There's a company in the States named First Solar. They're the leading manufacturer and producer and developer of large-scale solar systems and large-scale solar farms. The big deserts in Nevada are all made of First Solar's cadmium telluride thin film. This is copper indium selenide. It's diselenide, actually. They just take out the two. The problem with thin film, like I said, is it's a bit less efficient, but you can do cool things with it. So, I have on the next slide, I'm pointing it in the wrong direction, that's why. This is a good comparison in terms of the three silicon components, at least. If you have 1 meter squared of monocrystalline cells, you need approximately 1.2 meters squared of polycrystalline to get the same production, and you need 2.5 of thin film. So that just kind of gives you a relative comparison of those efficiency gains or drops, but like I said, it all comes down to the cost too. If one's way cheaper and you have more space, just throw a few more on there. Okay, this is basic electrical theory, which is not so basic for me, let's be honest, but these are really, really key principles for operating solar cells, why we do what we do, and the components we need to do what we do. So direct current, if we remember, is essentially current that flows in one direction. So it stays at a single voltage, and it's like putting water through a pipe, or water through a hose. So you turn on the faucet, it comes from one end and goes to the other. That's what direct current is. Alternating current is a current that reverses its polarity and direction. So it's essentially like a piston. It's shoving water backwards and forwards. In the nerdy graphical terms, it's a sine wave. If you want to take that away with you, it's a pretty picture. Why do we use one versus the other? So like Wikipedia has a great page on this if you want to know more. Essentially, there was a big battle in the Roman days. Like this goes far back. And what had happened was, direct current was being used to electrify cities, but the problem was they couldn't transmit it very far. They didn't have good materials like we do these days, so they had to have all these, what we know as like decentralized systems, so that they could power this community and then that community, and you might not have the same system as your neighbor. And it got a little arduous. So Tesla and Westinghouse, these are some of the people. There was essentially this big battle of direct current versus AC current, alternating, because alternating was able to be transmitted over long distances. So they electrified Rome with AC, and that's kind of where we all got our AC from. But then they were proving DC to be more powerful and better, But then there was a whole electrocuting an elephant in a square to prove DC was more dangerous. So like I said, like go to the Wikipedia page. It's actually quite interesting. But back in the day, AC was more efficient. It could travel distances. DC could not. Nowadays, there's no difference. DC is actually very efficient. We've even developed some high voltage DC lines for transmission purposes. But because we did everything in AC, that's kind of how everything's stayed. So what we do, why this is relevant to solar power, is because solar panels, they make DC power. They don't have the capability to alternate that power. So battery systems also store direct current power. So how do we get that into from the solar panel into our house? We use what's called inverters. So inverters take that direct current and they translate it into alternating current. Don't ask me how, it's all electrical nerdy stuff. Magic. There's always a bit of magic to science, isn't there? Yes, so this is on the tails of the Science March on Saturday, I shouldn't say that. We use inverters. There is a function that does the reverse of that. It's called a rectifier. So it's just these electrical tools that enable us to go from one to the other. So an inverter is crucial if you are using solar into your house, which operates on alternating current. So I'm going to whiz through the types of solar systems. So we have grid-connected, standalone or off-grid as we call them, solar concentrator systems, and solar thermal. We're not going to talk about solar thermal because that comes back to like chemical engineering and heat transfer, and no one needs to remember that textbook stuff. So grid-connected systems. You have your solar panel and your sun, and it creates DC power. So you put it through your DC-AC, your inverter, and then the inverter feeds it through the meter, which either determines that your house needs it or it goes back to the grid. This is the basic setup for your solar in your house. So it either goes back through the meter to the grid and you can be reimbursed for it, or your house is going to use it. It's a dual pathway. Standalone or off-grid. So if you're off the grid, you have a solar panel or array, and it goes through what's called a charge controller. The charge controller is kind of like the brain. It determines if the batteries are full or if they need the charge. If the batteries need the charge, it goes into the batteries. And then if the house needs it, it goes through the inverter to the house. If the batteries are full and they actually don't need it, it goes out here, which is actually, some charge controllers have their own, and other times you have to build it in. It's called a dump load. We just literally dump the power in the form of heat. So that's what these little baffles are kind of for. They dump it out because it's not required right now. Solar concentrator systems. There's actually two kinds, and I'll talk about the thermal one later, but these are often used interchangeably, incorrectly. So this is a concentrator PV system. We call them CPV, concentrator photovoltaics is what that stands for. This piece right here is actually a little tiny solar cell. And they use very, very high efficiency materials. So they use the gallium arsenide or those indium phosphides because they can afford to, because they don't need a lot. And so what you do is use mirrors to concentrate onto that high efficiency cell so you can generate a lot more power for a lot less cost. It gets really hot though. Solar thermal. So this is kind of a catch-all for what we heat water with. If you drive by Lake Southland Leisure Center, they have lots of solar thermal on their roof. But essentially they use these evacuated tubes with some black body collectors and they just heat water. It's very simple, very straightforward, but not at all related to the electricity side. So when people say solar, I always distinguish whether they mean solar thermal or solar PV because they're not the same. They're not the same equipment. You need completely two separate functions to be able to do this. Yeah, swimming pools. In the hotter climates especially. One of the things people have typically done with this is if you live in a colder climate and you put that on, it's heating only a certain amount. So if you're feeding it into a single hot water tank and it doesn't heat that hot, it's actually bringing down the rest of your hot water tank. So there's often a two hot water tank setup where it's like a preheater and an actual heater. So it does take a little more actual engineering and finagling, and those people have resilience to design those because they're usually trouble-filled. This is a solar thermal concentrator. So this is called, I think it's called CSP, concentrated solar power, but it's in terms of heat. So this is mirrors again to concentrate all that solar. But what it's actually doing is shooting at the top of this tower, which is heating a whole bunch of water, turning it into steam, and turning it conventional turbine. So it's not in any way electrical, except for when the turbine starts to generate electricity. But it's kind of converting that electrical or the photons into heat first, and then electricity. Again, kind of a totally separate mechanism from semiconductor photovoltaics, but often used interchangeably. So this is a super fun part. A lot of you will be familiar with it just because it's an integral part of if you pay bills, and since Ralph Klein's day, it's kind of shifted a couple times. But this is how our Alberta energy market works. It's kind of unique. It's a deregulated market, and all that means is there's a competitive auction bid for the price of electricity, which has kept our prices for electrical very, very low. So it's a pretty convoluted, complicated setup, and I'm going to run through a little bit of it. Just as a high level, here's the people and all these companies that are important, and the reason they're important is because whether you know it or not, you're actually paying them all off of your bill. So we're going to go through that a little bit, but I won't get too deep into that. So the general setup of the electricity grid is generators. It starts there because they have to generate the electricity. Then it goes through the transmission lines. So those are the high power, high voltage DC lines that you see with the big truss setups that go, the new Saskatchewan line is pretty beefy, but those are what we call the transmission system. Then they go through a transformer to the distribution system, which are the power lines outside. So that's ENMAX, EPCORs, and Edmonton. And then we get to consume it at the house. Those are kind of the four levels of the electricity grid. So here's some of the generators. You can't see this very well, but Pengrowth, Imperial, Genalta, ENMAX is up there. These are the generators. They have Shepherd Energy Plant, that's a gas-fired plant. They've got their coal plants. We've got our wind power. This is all generators. So they start from nothing and they give us power. Or they start with a fuel, obviously, but I mean, they're the start of the chain. Here's an interesting, this is a pretty old snapshot, July 2015, but essentially it shows a little bit of a breakdown of our power for that point in time. So capacity by fuel was 44% natural gas, 39% coal, 5% hydro, 9% wind, tiny little bit of biomass, and then a smidgy of whatever waste heat cogen processes they had going. So 100%? Oh. This was 16.2 at the time, megawatts, yeah. So Alberta's a really unique scenario for power. We have a really high industrial load because of our oil and gas. But our oil and gas also is in a unique position because they co-generate, which means that they produce power for their on-site, and then they're able to feed it back into the grid. So there's a very unique mix of high load, but high generation, and how it all comes together is what drives this competitiveness, which lowers our cost. So when everybody, you know, complains about the high cost of electricity here, if you actually look relative to literally anywhere else in the world, we are the lowest by a long shot. So some of the transmission companies, I like to point this out because he's a big stakeholder in Alberta that some people don't know about, but AltaLink has actually been bought by Berkshire Hathaway, which is Mr. Buffett's company. So Mr. Buffett owns a big stake in the Alberta electricity grid, and whether or not he's investor smart, understanding that that's, you know, a big shift is upon us, or the renewable energy piece, or the energy cogeneration, there's a big opportunity here that Buffett has identified and he is a part of. AltaLink is his company. I just wrote some more about it, but really, who needs that? Distribution. So what we call distribution, we call them wire owners or wire service providers, WSP. This is kind of a crude map, but it's a general setup. So we have ATCO in North Alberta. You get Fortis in all the rural areas, kind of. ATCO takes up some of those as well, but then the cities are run by themselves. So ENMAX owns the distribution in Calgary, EPCOR in Edmonton, the city of Red Deer has their own, Lethbridge, Fort McLeod. So this is WSP or distribution. Those are the wires we must maintain to get our energy. Retailers, this is the fun part. Because we have this deregulated system, you can buy your energy from whoever you want. I could start an energy company today and offer you a different price because I'm physically purchasing it from those distribution and transmission owners, but I can sell it to you for whatever I want. So when Just Energy used to be able to knock on your door, that's since been nixed, They can offer you whatever they want, hidden fees and all. So that's kind of what makes this a competitive market, because anyone and their dog can come and offer to sell you as a retailer, but that doesn't mean that they aren't regulated by the distribution and transmission. They can just kind of hide their fees wherever they want. So there's some Direct Energy, Just Energy, Easy Max, and NMAX. That's a program through NMAX, but these are some of the people you might have seen. Bullfrog Power, I don't think is I've put on here, but they're one too. So Spark is also what's known as like a little boutique retailer. Okay, so this is the super fun convoluted part of how our deregulated system works. So I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in this whatsoever, but there's Alberta Energy, that's our governmental department. The AUC is the regulatory body. They make all the rules. So they determine how everyone's allowed to interconnect as a microgen and what those rules and regulations for the whole system look like. The Department of Energy, that's the governmental department. They make the decisions. They initiate the regulation changes. Yeah, there's a lot there, sorry. You can, again, Wikipedia this till kingdom come. The AER, they mostly regulate the oil and gas side. So they have a hard line on emissions, and the oil and gas, they mandate the wells and kind of regulate that piece. The APMC is truly one of those things. I'm not quite sure about where they fit or what their purpose is, but they're there and we pay them. So again, post-closure stewardship fund, there's a whole bunch of these little levels and they perform different functions all amongst like the oil and gas versus the power versus the deregulated and the regulated market. And I'll touch in a bit as to why that may or may not be changing. So the balancing pool, they essentially manage, they manage assets and revenues. So when we deregulated the market, we needed that kind of third party middle ground to be that arbitrator who's like the middleman without having a stake in it. So that's their job, is to kind of be that middleman to facilitate everything without being on one side or the other. The MSA is actually, they're called Market Surveillance Administrator, and they're essentially policemen of the system. So if you're not doing something right, you're gonna be called by the MSA, and they're gonna blow the whistle on you, and they're going to cause a stink and report you to the AUC, who's essentially the regulator making the calls. Operators, this guy's your key, AESO. We call them AESO, Alberta Electric System Operator. They're the independent operator of our grid. So they make all the calls for all Alberta. They push the power down the power lines. If we need more in Calgary and they don't in Red Deer, they kind of shift that power. They operate the whole grid. So these guys are the ones that know what they're talking about. And they're key players, and they're set up to be an independent stakeholder. So they're not affiliated with generators. They're not affiliated with distribution owners. They're truly their own person, people. AESO's creating the structure for that auction, yes. So I'll touch on that in just a sec. So here's the big fancy picture. If you want to figure out how all this fits together, you basically got them all regulated under this big deregulated structure underneath the government and the AUC. So you have your balancing pool, your generators, your AESO, your transmission, distribution, retailers, AUC, MSA. Yeah, Google will help you decode that a little bit more. What's interesting about this deregulated structure, which I'll just mention in passing, is we're actually shifting away from that currently. So as I mentioned, this whole system and clean energy as a whole is it's a very dynamic market, but we're actually shifting as a province back towards more of a what we call a capacity market, which is regardless if you have that are able to bid into the pool for that low price energy, you're still going to be compensated if you have the ability to offer power. The capacity market is supposed to drive more investment. When we want to put in those big wind farms, they have no incentive to develop and to build right now because we have really low cost and oversupply. We've got more supply than we need. So how do you incentivize people to come in and develop that new energy? You have to change your market structure to facilitate both those sides. So while some people are concerned that that's going to drive up prices, it is and it isn't. They're still going to maintain this deregulated market to a point. So they're going to have deregulated prices with a capacity payment, and how all that's going to work is still being developed. And so that's why AESO is really important, because they're the ones developing this right now. They have a lot of stakeholders. They've had people from New Jersey and New York and the New England interconnection areas, and they're all coming up to give us their advice on how their system worked. And we get to learn from a lot of those wheels that have already been made. So here's hoping we do it right. It's not an easy thing, and I don't envy their position whatsoever. And I think it'll be really positive if we can get it right, because it will drive that investment and give people incentives to kind of stay in the game, which will keep our costs low, but also get paid for it, which will drive investment into the province. So as Doug just briefly mentioned, this auction he was talking about, the renewable energy piece is going through this new capacity market. So AESO is developing what they're calling the REP program, REP, Renewable Energy Procurement Program, or Renewable Energy Program. And so developers are currently ready to put their shovel in the ground, but they're having to go through a process where they go through a request for proposal process, and they put their capacity in and say, hey, we want to throw this into the grid, and people say yes or no. What's your cost? We'll allow you to have this much or that much. So we're going through an auction, a competitive auction, for the renewable capacity that we're going to be putting on as of December 2019, one of those two days, dates. So that's where the renewable energy development process is for Alberta. They're going through some key phases actually in the next month, but the goal is to have renewable energy development up and running in 2019 with a new capacity structure through an auction. So, that's a duplicate. Okay, understanding your electricity bill. Why does all this matter? How are we paying them, and what does that come through? So, your electricity portion, everybody's very familiar with. So you pay a variable electricity portion depending on how much electricity you use and what your cost is. That's what your cost on the bill is gonna be. So this, when I made this, it was typically around 8 cents, but I think since it's been reduced to about 6 if you've locked in with NMAX, 6 cents per kilowatt hour. So that's the energy portion we're talking about. It's $1 per kilowatt hour value. Then you have administration charges. These numbers I put up are NMAX specific. I'm assuming everyone here lives in Calgary, but there is Fortis specific ones and ATCO, and depending on who your distribution owner is, your administration charges will change. This is a fixed cost, but it's fixed per day. So per day of your energy bill, you pay that amount in administration charges. Then there's a distribution charge. As I mentioned, we have transmission and distribution lines. So this is a distribution charge. This is where the sneaky guys get you, because there's a daily charge and a per kilowatt hour charge. So if you save energy, you're actually only saving that much on your distribution charges. You're still gonna get charged your 50 cents per day on your bill. Again, NMAX specific. Transmission charge, so this is a variable amount depending on how much you pull from the grid. You're gonna get charged that much in energy. Then we have balancing pool allocation. The best, simplest way I can describe this is essentially the balancing pool says to AESO at the beginning of the year, we need this much money to run the system this year. And AESO goes, okay, cool. We'll take that off of everybody's bill and this amount per month. And they go, okay, cool, that's great. But what happens if they don't actually need all of that money? Sorry, I'm pointing in the wrong direction. If the balancing pool doesn't spend what they thought they were going to spend, it's a makeup value. So the rate riders, if you look on your bill, it's called a rate rider. If the balancing pool needs more than they thought, then it is a dock off your bill. You have to pay it. But if the balancing pool says, oh, we didn't actually use all of that, then they give it back to you in the form of a credit. So it's a variable. The last rate schedule I just looked at this morning was actually a refund in terms of as of January. So I don't know their budget cycles and when they determine this, but they were giving people money back as of January 2017 in your rate riders. So you can go check that out on your bill and see if they've budgeted well or not. Local access fee, this I find so interesting. It's basically like the City of Calgary saying, you live here, you pay us, that's it. It's funny because even in all the documents, it says the local access fee is a surcharge imposed by the City of Calgary, is not approved by the Alberta Utilities Commission, but it's applicable because you live here. So it's kind of like, oh, our governing body didn't make us pay it, but the city is. And what they use that for, really, I mean, I'm sure I could make a phone call and ruffle a few feathers, but let's just say Calgary is a good place to live. So. So, like I said, some on your bill are energy consumption related and other are charged regardless of your consumption. So this point here I bring up, because I've batted this around, but if you're talking in terms of solar power, if you put your solar up on your roof and you're home and you're using it, that's less you're consuming from the grid. Now that you know what your electricity bill looks like, if you're using less from your grid, there's going to be less fees associated with it. So it's actually more economic to use the power you generate instead of the contracts, which in NMAX state, if you're going to export your electricity to us, we're only going to give you your electricity rate. They're not reimbursing you for any transmission, distribution, local access. They're not reimbursing you any of that. You get your straight 6 cents, the end. So it's kind of, if you have to go to work in the day and you're generating solar in the day, it's not the most ideal scenario, and it's not really apples for apples yet. Let's hope that the new government cycles kind of figure that out, because there is a gap there in terms of we're still paying, let's say, an average of 10 cents per kilowatt hour, but if we export to the grid, we're only getting 6. So that's a bit of a contentious issue globally, not Alberta-based. This is something that the U.S. has been struggling for. They call it net metering instead of net billing. It's net billing is the term if it's coming in and out of the meter. You're billed for what's coming in and out. Net metering is truly that. How do you monetize all of that contribution that you're not using? If I don't need transmission lines because I have solar panels, why am I paying for them? So I'll whip through the design process, and then I'll give us a 5-minute stand-up break, because then there's some math after. But it's good math. It's the math that everyone will want. It's the math of how much are you going to produce? How much is this going to cost? How much will I get back? What are my savings look like? So I'm going to run through that at just a high level, but first I'll go through how we quickly design and then give us a little bit of a stretch. So designing a system. Consider what type of panels you want, how much space you have on your roof. Is shading going to be an issue? So I didn't really touch on this yet, but I'm going to right now. The way that solar panels are wired, they have the cells and they're wired together in series and parallel, depending on the arrangement. So what happens in electricity is if you wire something in series, it's like those Christmas lights. If one goes out, the whole string goes out. So to mitigate that, you wire them in parallel. But what happens is, because of the way modules are manufactured, the cells, some of them are inevitably in series. So the second you shade one, that whole string is mandated to be affected, because that current needs to stay the same through the series. So if you get a bird that poops on that one cell, your whole current drops in that part of the module. But then if you shade one panel, that whole string that's strung in series can also be affected. So shading is something that it's okay, the sun will come around and it'll be fine, but it's actually like a really significant piece, and shading is very misunderstood and very not properly utilized in terms of, I see people putting panels behind trees and I just like shiver, because it's just not very well understood how that drastically impacts the system. Which direction will your panels be facing? Hopefully south. Any other way is like not ideal. Southwest, southeast. The benefits to having southwest or southeast is you're going to be generating more power in the nighttime if it's southwest facing. So if you're home and you're using your power in the evening, perhaps it's not bad to do southwest. But those kind of benefits are, they're not well studied, they're not well known, and it really, at this northerly latitude, it's not, I wouldn't recommend it at this stage of the game. Let's put it that way. Inverter structure. One of the ways that we mitigate that shading losses and all of those kind of effects and drops that can happen in the design is by using a different type of inverter. So we can use a string inverter, which is all those panels strung together in one big clunky thing at the end that just transmits all the power, changes it from DC to AC, or we can use microinverters. What that means is one inverter per panel. So essentially, if that one panel is shaded, only that one panel is going to be affected. It's not strung together with any of the rest of them. Does add a bit more cost, but it can save you a lot because you're generating more energy. And they're actually getting quite reasonable in cost, and it just makes designing the system a whole lot easier, because then you don't have to design how it's all linked together. Consider your optimal angle if you can. Typically for residential systems, we just put them flush mount. It is not the most ideal angle, but there are other considerations, such as like the structural load that your roof can handle. If the snow gets added on top of that, that's a snow load. And then if it's windy, it can pull on those panels and add different forces that our roofs are not made to handle. The easiest and most straightforward application is flush against the roof of your house. Racking type, ballasting. Ballasting means some of those commercial rooftops don't have enough structural support to be perforating the roof. So what they do is they have really unique racking systems where you can put little concrete blocks strategically down, and it basically is kind of a self-supporting system on the top of the roof without having to rely on the building structure. The application process. So you can you apply for your building and electrical permits. There's actually a streamlined process, hopefully through the through the City of Calgary, that I've seen that kind of dictates what permits you need for what system, and this is a newly released thing, so you can Google that, but you always need an electrical permit because you're messing with your electrical. Building, you shouldn't need. Then you apply to your wire service provider, so your NMAX, your EPCOR. You apply to them, but you fill out the AUC's information because they're the ones who've created the regulation. You fill their sheet out and send it to your wire service provider, and the sheet looks like this. So it's the micro generation application guide. It's pretty straightforward. Solar is very easy to apply for. There's no noise regulations, environmental impact. It's really, really quite a straightforward little guide. Then you can do your installation. Once you have your okay to install, you call your professionals, and they will do all this for you. If you find a company, they'll do this all for you, but it helps to understand the process so you know how long it should take, what to expect. So they'll install it, they'll schedule your inspection based on your electrical permit, and then what happens, this one's a bit funky, and I hope we're working on this piece. So once it's been passed by the electrical inspector, you have to call your wire service provider. You have to call NMAX and say, okay, cool, everything's good, we're good to go, can you come swap out my meter? Because meters in conventional communities have only been made to run in one direction, from the grid to your house. But if you put in solar, it needs to go back to the grid so they can count how much you're actually giving back to them. So they need to put in a bi-directional meter. So you call them and say, can you come put this in? And in my case, a couple of times, Fortis and NMAX have both said, yeah, for sure, we'll be there in like 1 to 2 weeks. And I go, okay, cool, can you let me know when it's done? And they say, maybe like go outside and take a picture so that you know when it looks different, it's done. And I go, can you just like please let me know, because that's ridiculous. So I hope they're working on this. I haven't done a system in a year, so I'm not sure, but it's pretty funny because it's at the mercy of their field schedules and gosh knows what, but apparently it looks different, and if you take a picture and have a spy out there to see when they show up, that's the best way to know. So they swap out your meter, then you can turn on the system. That's the exciting part. This is at Mom's house. She has a system. And this was a day, I like to point this out, she was actually on vacation. So this was a resting load. So this is what her house cycle looks like when nobody's home. This is probably the house heat kicking it up a couple notches. I don't even know what these loads are, my brother might. It's refrigerator and like anything with an output, so the microwave still has a light. That's the resting load and all that stuff. This here, Jeff actually came home to get the dogs. I wasn't tracking him, I just knew that he went home to get the dogs. And this is the generation curve here. So this is a very cool system called an E-gauge, and it tracks your usage and your generation, which is very cool to put them on top of each other. So this is the generation here, and it wasn't a very good day. There was lots of clouds. I think it was one of those blue sky patchy cloud days. And then I think he dropped the dogs off here and then went back home. So that was that day. I have a pretty graph at the end as well of a much better day, and you'll see that. And I want to leave you with one thing before we stretch and go to small-scale economics. The biggest misconception for solar, I mentioned, in the desert versus Alberta, is that solar works great in sunny, hot climates. And that is very true. Solar works great in sunny, hot climates because that's where the most sun is. However, solar energy actually performs better in cold climates. And that is because the characteristic curve of a solar silicon cell specifically is, I had it in another presentation, but essentially it looks like this. And the second that you climb up in temperature, the voltage actually drops significantly. So you get way less maximum power out of a hot and increasingly hot cell. So the more sun you have on it, the hotter those panels are getting, the actual less efficient it's getting. So in Calgary, with our great sun and our cold temperatures, this is actually way more ideal than the desert of Nevada and Utah and New Mexico and. One of the benefits of thin film is it actually does not degrade in the same fashion as the crystalline silicon. So that is why those desert applications always use thin film panels, because they're not going to degrade, they're going to perform better, and they have the space, so let's throw a couple more down. So we're cold and we're sunny. This is better than Vegas. Who knew I would say that? Let's let's get up and stretch for a few minutes, and then I'll finish off with some math, and then let you guys go, because it's a long night. We'll come back in like five, just 5.